I'm kind of conscious that many of you are not Pacific specialists, and what I'm going to talk about is quite a large topic, so I'm going to do what I actually hate doing, but I'm going to actually read this paper because I know if I start talking, I will riff and go off topic and not finish it. So I think it's better just to read it, so I crave your indulgence for that. So this paper is an introduction to an Indigenous oral traditions recording program that has been going on for the last 30 years in Vanuatu, a small nation in the Western Pacific. During the time that the program has been operating, much has changed in Vanuatu. I've been concerned with this program for 20 of those 30 years, working with my Nifanuatu colleague Jean Tarisese to found and then to build up a women's oral traditions program. In this paper, I'm going to introduce Vanuatu and the program, and there are a great many observations that could be made about it, but I'm going to focus my comments on the impact of social transformation on the program and on the recording of oral traditions. I'm going to focus specifically on the recording of stories and histories. One can, of course, commit any form of knowledge or information to a tape recorder, but the oral traditions recording program, although it has expanded into much wider territory, started with stories and histories, and it is the fate of these aspects of cultural knowledge in particular that interests me here. Vanuatu, formerly the New Hebrides, gained independence in 1980. It's based on a long archipelago of over 80 islands, which runs north-south, about 1,000 kilometres east of Australia. It was first settled some 3,000 years ago by Austronesian speakers, who sailed there in double-hulled canoes from northern Papua New Guinea, and who later sailed on to settle the whole of the rest of the Pacific. The present population of Vanuatu is about 245,000. Actually, I noticed in the abstract I wrote 145,000, which means I must have had a momentary slip back 15 years. Those 245,000 people speak 113 Indigenous languages, and the three national languages are English, French and Bishlama, the last being the lingua franca. 30 years ago, when the oral traditions programs first started, those 113 languages were spoken by only about 120,000 people. Vanuatu comprises mostly volcanic islands. Their terrain is mostly rugged and mountainous. Sea travel's always been the best way to get about. There are more cultural groups than there are languages, and every place, every district, every small valley has its own history, ceremonial practice, and traditions. Each separate society was connected with others by kinship, warfare, and trade. People traded for material goods, but they also traded for intangible resources like knowledge and ritual. Men purchased ceremonial cycles from each other and the songs and stories that went with them. There are even recorded instances of the exchange of language. In the island where I did my doctoral research, Ambai, from the north of the country, people from one district, liking features of the dialect in the adjacent district, purchased the rights to speak certain words from their neighbours. A linguist known to some of you, Katrina Hislop, who worked in the district from which the words were purchased, told me that even in the 1990s, people still occasionally clapped their hands over their mouths when they had used a word they had sold. By selling them, they lost the right to speak them. The archipelago, fortunately for it, had no resources attractive to Europeans. It wasn't unsettled until after 1840, and then only by a scattering of planters and missionaries. In 1887, Britain and France signed a joint naval agreement by which both nations patrolled the archipelago to protect the interests of those of their nationals who had taken land there. In 1906, this morphed into the Anglo-French Condominium Government of the New Hebrides. Created mainly to provide the legal machinery for alienating land, the joint administration paid little attention to the administration of the islanders spending more time fighting about whose flag was flying higher, and many islanders remained more or less ignorant of their colonised state. The US presence during the Second World War tripled the population of the archipelago for a few years and introduced both new ideas and new facilities. But it wasn't until the 1960s that the colonial government began to pay substantial attention to the islanders. The most significant impacts on people in the archipelago until the 1970s were opportunities to work in plantations within Vanuatu, but also in Queensland and Fiji, and missionisation. The Presbyterians were the dominant denomination, the Anglicans operating mainly in the north. The Anglicans were somewhat lenient about the maintenance of Indigenous knowledge and practice, whereas the Presbyterians characterised the pre-contact past as a time of darkness. On the whole, darkness or not, people throughout the archipelago continued living on their own land, providing most of their own needs from that land by food gardening, fishing, and planting and caring for trees. I've spent time detailing this history because it is important to the foundation of the Oral Traditions Program. The condominium government had founded a cultural centre in 1956. Prompted by several developments in the 1970s, the Cultural Centre Board of Management decided to develop an oral traditions recording program, this being the era in the South Pacific when oral traditions recording became extremely popular. The program started in 1976 with funding from the South Pacific Commission. In a manner quite characteristic of the Anglo-French condominium government, which founded two hospitals, two prisons, and two legal systems, two approaches were used. A French linguist trained 10 students from the Teachers College who were sent to the islands for short periods to make recordings. The English approach, initiated by the then museum curator, an Englishman called Kirk Huffman, and a New Zealand ethnomusicologist called Peter Crow, was to train four men from North Vanuatu, all of whom were knowledgeable about practices in their own communities, in other words, four village men. Huffman and Crow were explicit about their objectives for the project, which were not so much to make recordings as, quote-unquote, to get people interested in the documentation and revival of their cultures. The timing of this was crucial, for the 70s were the era of the fight for independence in the archipelago. The British were eager to divest themselves of the colony, but the French were not. And the need for an independence movement made it necessary for the islanders to conceive of themselves as a group distinct from both British and French, with their own separate and legitimate identity. And, of course, they'd never thought of themselves as a group before. The independence movement leaders made considerable use of the concept of custom, K-A-S-T-O-M in Bishlama, a term which can be understood to mean the practices of the place as opposed to the practices that come from outside, from overseas, from elsewhere. So Huffman and Crow were attempting to get people interested in documenting and reviving their custom, just as people throughout the region, informed by programs on the shortwave radio and by word of mouth, were starting to think about custom as something to be proud of, rather than as something that belonged to the time of darkness. Indeed, as I have argued at more length elsewhere, it is clear that as it developed, the Oral Traditions Program gave substance to the political rhetoric about custom as the basis for identity, providing a way to think about and act on custom in the new context of the nation. Huffman, as museum curator, took Crow's initial model of oral traditions recording and expanded it. He built up the group of oral traditions trainees, whom he dubbed field workers, with the objective, never yet realised, of appointing one in each language group. The two crucial characteristics of his appointees were that they were volunteers and that there were people living within their communities at village level. There was no requirement for Western education. Quite a number of field workers could neither read nor write. Huffman appointed men who were passionately interested in the custom of their own region or district. The first field workers were trained to make recordings on reel-to-reel tape recorders. Later, each field worker was given a cassette recorder, batteries, and blank tapes. Recognising the importance of language to the maintenance of local knowledge and practice, in 1981, Huffman recruited a linguist, Daryl Tryon, to start running workshops for the field workers. In the beginning, these annual two-week training workshops concentrated on teaching field workers to write their languages and hence to enable the transcription of stories in languages. This early goal for the program, transcription and publication, has since almost entirely died away. It is the spoken word rather than its publication, which is now important. The early workshops were concerned with language and transcription, and they focused, therefore, on recording what is known in Vanuatu as custom stories, the histories, myths, and entertainments that people know and tell each other. Gradually, the workshops expanded to teach basic documentation techniques from anthropology and linguistics, including, for example, the making of basic language dictionaries and the writing of genealogies. As well as tape recorders, field workers were given hard-backed exercise books in which to write their research results. The recordings that the field workers made were stored in a special room at the cultural centre called the Taboo Room. It has the sense both of containing what is restricted but itself also being restricted. Because knowledge is a resource and a valuable which can be exchanged, it was necessary to make a number of rules about who could access the recordings before people in the islands would allow field workers to record them and before the field workers themselves were willing to deposit the recordings. So, field workers were and are able to place restrictions on who could and can listen to the recording. If it involves highly sensitive material, only the immediate family and descendants of the speaker might have access to the recording. Other material is identified as being freely available, and in fact was and is often broadcast on the Cultural Centre's weekly radio programme on the shortwave radio station. The group of men field workers has met annually since 1981, and there are now about 65 men field workers. The women field workers group, which is in the slide, and which I have the privilege of chairing, was founded in 1994 and has met annually ever since. There are currently about 35 women in that group. Two of Crow's original trainees stayed in the men field workers group for a quarter of a century, retiring just a few years ago. But there are other men who have been in the group almost from the beginning. As has been discussed elsewhere, individual field workers have achieved extraordinary amounts in both documenting and recording their own group's knowledge and practice, and in reviving and maintaining aspects of it. The field workers have been meeting annually through three decades of the most intensive cultural change in the archipelago since the original settlement of the islands. The creation of the nation of Vanuatu, the increasing spread of monetarisation, the election of members of parliament, the provision of education, the rise and fall of the copra industry have all changed aspects of island life, as have the availability of inter-island air transport, the growth of urban centres, the spread of DVD players, and most recently and most destructively, the introduction of mobile phones. By far the biggest impact has been the massive population growth. The population has doubled since independence, and more than 60% is under 20. People say they no longer have enough old people to train and teach the young people. The anthropologist Stephen Feld, whose research is in Basavi, Papua New Guinea, makes the very good point that memory, maintaining oral tradition, is work. He says, "One of the things I've learned in Basavi is that memory is not a luxury, as it is in the West. It is a social obligation. Sharing the stories and what you know, working on the meaning of the past, reinvigorating and acknowledging who and what made you as you are, these are all social necessities in village life. The purpose of the fieldworker program is, in effect, to encourage people to do that work of memory, to reinvigorate and acknowledge local identity and to keep hold of it. This has both become more important in the face of massive cultural change and more difficult. When Huffman began developing the fieldworker network, he argued that in most parts of the country, custom was not dead, but sleeping. In other words, he argued that knowledge about ceremony and history was still available in the community and could be used to revive practices that had fallen into disuse. Because the impact of the colonial government had been quite light, especially in areas where planters and missionaries had less influence, much knowledge had been retained. In Stephen Feld's terms, people had still been doing the work of memory. Huffman encouraged the performance of ceremony, the wearing of traditional costume, the transmission of history. Both he and even more so his successor, Ralph Reginvanu, who's himself Nifanuatu and who was director of the Cultural Centre until 2007, both of them used documentation, the recording of oral histories, as a technique for revival, as a way to make people do that memory work. Thus, if someone recorded a story or a song, chances were that other people would be listening and might learn and remember what they had heard recorded. There is a danger that when a story has been told to a tape recorder, people no longer feel the need to do the work of remembering it, but rather assume that it's now safe, accessible, and therefore actually forgettable. It's always been more important to the cultural centre that knowledge is alive and working in a community than that it is recorded and stored. In chairing the Women Fieldworkers Workshops, I and my colleague Jean Tarisese have always argued that whether or not people will allow the recording of a story, the most important thing is to persuade them to pass it on to the most appropriate person so that the knowledge itself moves down the generations. The point about oral traditions, of course, is that while they might refer to the past, they always exist in the present. A story or history, however ancient, is always retold to the present context, to a particular audience, whom the teller takes into account in the telling. Certain aspects of the story may be exaggerated or alternatively omitted for that audience, and the teller may also forget some aspect of the telling. Thus, a recording made of a story at a particular point in time will never be the definitive version. Sometimes several versions of a story or song end up being recorded over a period of years, which will in the future provide an interesting opportunity for comparison. Just skipping a bit, time is marching on. The other advantage of the fieldworker workshops is that because people are fieldworkers for many decades, they have the opportunity to grow in their understanding of what they're doing. And my colleague Jean Tarisese, who ran the network and who's just retired to become a fieldworker herself, has commented how much more she knows now than she did before about how to do this work. And people like this man in the yellow T-shirt, Jerry Taki, he's devoted 2 decades to piecing together information about a particular ritual cycle on his island of Eremango. So the fieldworker network enables fieldworkers to do their own research and to do very substantial, important work. I just want to quickly, if I may, just consider one particular aspect of the whole program that I think is quite important to the subject of this conference, but I don't know whether it's familiar to everyone or not. But stories and histories always make sense in certain specific contexts, and in Vanuatu, one of the most important contexts is place. Attachment to place is characteristic of all Ni-Vanuatu societies. Most languages use an absolute spatial reference system whereby location and movement are described not in reference to the speaker's own location, as in English, but in reference to the landscape. When people speak about the location of objects, they always do so with respect to the place itself rather than in relation to themselves. Moreover, as Bob Rubenstein has demonstrated, in Vanuatu, people validate the truth of a statement by reference to the landscape, not as English speakers do by reference to time. They don't say, "I heard that story on Friday morning," but rather, "I heard that story when I was standing where the path crosses the creek bed." Stories are always located in the immediate landscape of that particular group. Major stories always involve named places and the movement of beings and other people and other beings across them. This makes it difficult for them to be understood by someone who doesn't know that particular landscape, especially as quite commonly characters in them end up becoming known features of the landscape, like a rock standing in the sea, for example. When such small stories are transcribed and published, as some have been, they lose a great deal of their potency by being divorced from the landscape that gives them the specific logic. More important stories are even more crucially linked to landscape, describing why people in one region have something that people in another don't. I'll just skip again. Another issue that relates to understanding these stories is to do with what might be described as cultural logic. Stories were often told to demonstrate points or make connections, and in doing so, they use kinds of logic and understandings appropriate to the language group. But as the population is more and more educated in a Western system, more and more familiar, for example, with the storytelling logics in the action movies they watch on DVDs, they themselves become detached from the forms of proof that made sense to their grandparents. I think this significantly disempowers oral traditions. And I think it's a very important thing to think about, or for me to think about. The fieldworker program has greatly expanded. Fieldworkers do a lot more now than make recordings. They can organise mini arts festivals, train dance groups, look after researchers, revive textiles and other kinds of artefacts. Recording custom stories has lessened in importance as other tasks have risen in importance. This may also link to a reduction in the importance of the stories themselves. For the reasons I have just been outlining, stories, the points they make, the logic they exemplify, seem less important in 2009, even than when I first went to Vanuatu in 1989. For all these and other reasons, the importance of recording has lessened as a part of the fieldworker project over the last decade. Each year at the workshop, the fieldworkers choose a research project for the following year and report on it the following year. The idea is that they should always include stories and histories, but fewer and fewer fieldworkers think to tell them. Whereas formerly all fieldworkers had a tape recorder and brought recordings to the cultural centre every year, that is less and less the case, partly because of funding, but partly, I think, because of interest. More and more people prepare their reports by writing them in a book. If the rate of additions to the taboo room has slowed, the archive, now running to thousands of hours and currently being digitised by cultural centre staff, is an unbelievable resource of cultural knowledge and understanding. I'd just like to conclude with a small story about the use of this resource today. Recordings made over three decades by the field worker in the southernmost inhabited island of Aneityum, Philip Tepehai, in the photograph, became very important in 2008. France made a claim in the United Nations for two uninhabited islands, Matthew and Hunter, which lie between southern Vanuatu and New Caledonia, and which are currently part of Vanuatu. The French claim is prompted by mineral resources under the sea. Stories recorded by Tepehai in the Cultural Centre archive demonstrated historic connections between Aneityum and Matthew and Hunter. When these were presented by the Vanuatu government in a report to the United Nations, the French government withdrew their claim. In this instance, the way stories in Vanuatu are always located in place proved to be of the utmost importance. Thank you.